accession number 11731.
Real one.
Mr. Palmer, real one. Whereabouts were you born, please?
Edgbaston, which is a district of Birmingham.
What did your father do for a living?
Very little, really. He was almost blind, unfortunately. So he was supported more or less by, if you like, voluntary contributions. My eldest sister was, as a result of his blindness, conceived and was born blind. So we had another liability there.
Did you go to school in Edgbaston?
Well, in Harbin, actually.
And how old were you when you left school?
14.
To do what?
I went to work for an educational company called the Midland Educational Company Limited, which really was a name for selling books, Bibles, stationery to schools and things.
How did you come to be in the forces then?
Well, my mother was a musician. She was a teacher of ballet, my mother. That's how we kept the home going, really. She was a teacher of ballet and a very good pianist. And my father had a very good voice. Consequently, between them, they used to earn a little bit of money in music. And I had shown some, what you say, leanings toward music. And my mother said to me, I intend to put you to the violin. Which she did, at very great expense to her, in the form of sixpence per week to buy a violin. In those days, that's what it cost. A violin was about £2.10, which was a lot of money. But you could buy it through the school at sixpence per week. And I showed a great interest in it. I became quite good for my age. I had a very good teacher, a man called Woolliscroft, who was the lead violinist at the Alexandra Theatre in Birmingham. And he brought me along, and eventually I did get a place in this little theatre orchestra. Having said that, I lost my job at the Midland Educational through a rather boyish prank, which I hadn't better relate. Consequently, I was a floating boy with the only thing that I could do was a little bit of music. And I was wandering past the recruiting office in Snow Hill, Birmingham, one day, and I saw this advert for Royal Marine Band boys, young musicians. So I took myself in, got the details of the entry, enlistment, and in a very short time, I was called for and told that I would have to take an examination, that the enlistment would actually depend upon the amount of musical knowledge appropriate to my age. And as I was then almost 15, I suppose, I don't know how they would assess a musical talent commensurate with that age, but they did allow me to sign on, and I duly signed on in the Royal Marine Band Service when I think my records will show that I was about 16, I think,
Yes, because it was in 1933.
That's right.
And you were born in 1917.
17, so I would be whatever.
You were telling me earlier that there are various things you feel strongly ought to be tape-recorded about the Royal Marines bandsman. Can you tell me what that is?
Well, yes. I can lead up to it by best saying that when I finished my training, the object of the exercise was the Royal Naval School of Music were providing bands for ships and shore establishments, of course, mainly for ships, because the Royal Navy was very large then and we had any amount of ships. And the purpose was to get a band of a certain size on a ship, depending the size of the band, depending upon the size of the ship, etc., etc., and whether it carried a flag and things like that. And having done my training, and you had to be a double-handed instrumentalist, because one, you had to perform in a military band of whatever size, you also had to be able to play a musical instrument which was suitable for an orchestra, i.e. violin, cello, string bass, oboe, or whatever. And in my particular case, my double-handed instruments were violin and clarinet and sax. So I was able to perform in those three dimensions, if you like. And one day on the notice board, lo and behold, my name appeared with a bandmaster, a band corporal, 13 bandsmen, I think, and one band boy, which was me. And I was sent to Plymouth with the band, of course, and joined HMS Berwick, which belonged to the 10th Cruiser Squadron serving in China. And at 16 years of age, that was a very great adventure. Off I went to China with a lump in my throat, leaving Plymouth Harbour, playing Rule Britannia or something. Anyway, I served something like about 4 years there. In between the whole of the commission, the length of the commission, we were called to the Mediterranean to take part in the patrol work and keep the Italians back out of Abyssinia. They were at the time invading Abyssinia. We did that particular area, and when it was all over and Italy withdrew, we then sailed back to China, where we completed our commission, at the end of which I came home. Now, when you come home, back you come back to your home base, which is the Royal Marine School of Music, or the Royal Naval School of Music as it was then, and there you do your training and take part in the local bits and pieces, maybe get a shore base, maybe go to Canada with a touring band, or get posted to another ship. In my case, I was jolly unlucky. I didn't spend much time ashore. I was posted to another ship, which was an aircraft carrier, Courageous, running out of Portsmouth. I served on that thing for whatever length of time it was on there. I forget.
About 2 years.
Yes.
From 37 to 39.
That's right. Then, war was becoming, what should we say, imminent, and the Navy were reshuffling all sorts of things, and aircraft carriers were at that time an unknown quantity and quality indeed, insofar as warfare was concerned. So they were anxious to keep as many carriers seaworthy, if you like, and operational in the event of war breaking out. And the one thing they did with us, the Courageous was due for refitting and repairs and all sorts of things, but the crew, including the band of course, were used to operating on a carrier, and so they transferred us to another carrier, which merely meant that we pulled into Portsmouth. They lowered the gangway, the band marched down the gangway along the jetty to the next ship, which was HMS Furious, another carrier, and we went up the gangplank on there, and we served on there for a couple of years. We were actually in the North Sea when war was declared, sitting outside the Baltic, presumably waiting for the German Grand Fleet to come out and have battle royal, which they didn't do. So after a certain length of time, they decided to disband the fleet, if you like, which consisted of an enormous amount of ships, and send them back to Scapa Flow, which is our base, which they did. Then came the Norwegian campaign, and the only operational carrier we had left in the Royal Navy was HMS Furious, which was us. So they put us off Norway, and what we had to do was to get the aircraft flying off, usually at dawn raids, to get into the fjords to try and bomb the German shipping. Unfortunately, of course, All we had was swordfish, the now called string bags, the Gloucester Gladiator, and a few other bits and pieces which were really of no use at all. And it wasn't very long before the numbers of aircraft we had in, we had three squadrons aboard, were very sadly depleted. And another way that they were depleted was the fact that the swordfish couldn't carry an awful lot of fuel. And if you lay, say, 100 miles off the Norwegian coast and you flew your aircraft off at dawn, which was the usual thing, the poor things could never get back because they'd run out of petrol. And it was quite commonplace to hear an aircraft on its way back from a raid coming on the intercom saying that he was going to have to ditch because he was out of fuel, which was very sad. And particularly if you knew the crews, which you did.
Was there much chance of rescuing them?
Well, there was an attendant destroyer, but I mean, it was almost impossible to get that destroyer in the various places where they were ditching. So consequently, we lost most of them. But there was another outlet in that, for reasons that only the pilot could tell you, if he had delivered his attack and he hadn't got any chance of getting back to the carrier, because remember the carrier had turned round and was steaming back to Scapa Flow as quick as possible, the pilot would decide to go to neutral territory, usually Sweden. Then we would hear that Lieutenant Commander so-and-so in Foxtrot, Tango Foxtrot, had in fact landed at Uppsala Airport in Sweden and had been interned. So that's another angle to it, which is quite unusual. We were pleased, of course, jolly good. They'd got rid of the war and they were safe. That was that.
Did the German Air Force launch many attacks on the Furious?
No. No, not then, no. They weren't, I don't think they had, well, they hadn't really got the settled bases. I mean, their lines of communication were so long that I think they really could only use the sea rather than the air as a means of attack. Hence the Narvik, the Narvik raid, where the H-class destroyers, Lieutenant Commander
Warburton
Lee, no, Captain Warburton Lee, yes, I beg your pardon, Captain Warburton Lee, VC, yes, he was a VC, led the Hardy and the Hotspur and the Havoc through into this fjord and did immense damage and then couldn't get out. Things like that were happening all the time. The Furious was running out of fuel and things like that. We couldn't fly our aircraft off. All sorts of little odds and ditties and things were going on. Anyway, Furious. The end of the Furious.
What job would you do when you weren't playing in the band during action stage?
This is the crunch. The old-fashioned idea was that a bandsman was a stretcher bearer. A stretcher bearer, that's nonsense. It really is nonsense. In fact, when a band is allocated to a ship or commissioned to a ship, dependent upon the time of upon the type of guns aboard the ship or the method of controlling the guns, so the band were sent to the local gunnery school, be it Whale Island or wherever the ship was commissioning from, and you did training on gunnery control. Gunnery control on board any ship goes in the form of a transmitting station. The transmitting station being in the bowels of the ship, where it is allegedly, and I say that very carefully because later on you will see what I mean, safe. So, and what happens there is that the bridge and all the bristling of the guns, they are range takers and range finders and later radar operators. They would give us the course of the enemy ship, if it was a ship, or the aircraft, whichever it was. That information was relayed down to the transmitting station by mechanical means, a sort of computer, an old-fashioned computer thing. There we would estimate things like ballistics, which insofar as gunnery is concerned means the temperatures of the various layers of the atmosphere, the distance of the target, the direction in which the target was going, the speed it was going, our speed, our direction, and all that information would then be sent back to the gun, and the elevation of the gun the information that is given indicates the elevation of the gun, because as you know, you fire a gun, the shell doesn't go straight. That's called fixed sight. The shell goes up and it falls. So all that direction, velocity, is ballistics. And that was our job, to assess it. Very complicated. And it was a very comprehensive course. So that aboard the ship, a marine bandsman would be doing two duties. Music, in the form of military band for the hoisting of the flag and the lowering of the flag, saluting other ships that passed, foreign ships. Also aboard the ship, in the string instrumentalist side, when you formed the orchestra, you were playing for various functions aboard the ship, like officers' dinners and things like that, and captains always had their own dinners and things like that. And when you weren't doing that, you were down in the transmitting station, swatting up on your computer stuff. When you were actually in peacetime, when you were actually touring or cruising, as you called it, as for instance in China, where I was for something like 4 years, you would go to a place like Tinsin, where there would be a British consul or an embassy, and things would happen there in that the captain of the ship would invite the consul and his staff, or the ambassador and his staff, aboard ship for a cocktail party, and the Royal Marine Band would be playing. Likewise, the thing would be returned in that the KLN Mining Administration would ask the captain to have lunch or dinner or whatever with him, and likewise we would go with the captain and play for that function. Also, of course, in the case of if you were abroad in where there was trouble, very often the old naval saying, show the flag, will frighten them. That's the same sort of thing. What used to happen was that the Royal Marine Detachment, which was usually between 100 and 200 men, would go ashore with as many blue jackets, similarly trained in normal rifle carrying and things like that, and we, the band, would go ashore too, lead the parade through the streets wherever it was, and it would quell whatever riots you had, or it would certainly make a difference dependent upon the situation. But principally, now of course when we became active in war, exactly the same things happened, particularly with regard to the transmitting station. Now I have here a list of, it's a roll of honour in fact, of ships that went down with a band, and you will find that in that roll of honour, some of them, the complete band were killed, only because they were trapped below in the transmitting station. And it's a pretty comprehensive list. That you may keep that if you wish.
Thank you. So this role of honour and the number of people lost, number of musicians and yes. band masters lost,
and band boys, yes,
indicates how dangerous it was.
Yes.
In action for the band's
yes.
people on the ship.
That's right. Oh yes,
Her Majesty's ship.
Very much so. If I may bring you home to a little closer to, for instance, the Trinidad. If you would wish me to relate that,
yes, please.
Now or later,
yes,
I don't mind.
Can you do it now?
Well. Trinidad was a cruiser of the colony class, and you will find in there were four colony class cruisers sunk. Whether that was because they were peculiarly built, I don't know, but certainly the transmitting station was in a most dangerous position. It was well down in the bowels of the ship and surrounded, unfortunately, by oil tanks. It's supposed to be surrounded. You would normally put a vulnerable area like that surrounded by more solid like things like the flour store or something, you know, anything that would take impact, because remember it's quite a considerable way below the waterline. In the case of the Trinidad, these ships were built with surrounded by oil tanks. And unfortunately, what happened with the Trinidad was we were supporting PQ-13, a convoy bound from Iceland to Murmansk.
PQ what number?
PQ-13. It's in Frank Pierce's book. What had happened was, I believe, the convoy before us was supported by an HMS Edinburgh, which was a city-class cruiser. Now, she had, I believe, dropped Norwegian commandos off northern Norway, and they had to get into the mountains surrounding, I believe, Narvik. And they were fitted with radio transmitters, and it was their job to report the movement of enemy shipping in Narvik, where most of the German war shipping was laid up for one reason or another. And we had a report from Admiralty that presumably via these commandos that a force of, I think, five German destroyers had left Narvik harbour and taken a northerly course, which indicated that they were after the convoy PQ-13. Now, we were screening to the southward of this convoy deliberately to get in between anything that might come from Norway and the convoy to protect it. And we were not lucky, but we were extremely efficient about it, because at that time Germany's radar systems were getting a little bit outdated, I think. And we were getting on top insofar as radar was concerned. And we actually, by radar, contacted these five German destroyers before they knew we were there. Now, it then became a bit of a battle in that we came across these and we found them in a snowstorm, only because our radar was, in my opinion, more efficient. And there was the Z-20, I think 23, 24, 25 and 26, in that order, a sort of half flotilla in line ahead, and we came across them at the stern. That's because of our radar, we were able to pick them up without them knowing that we were there. And all the practice that you had done about opening fire and the procedures that you'd taken suddenly came to life. And I can remember the command, enemy bearing so-and-so, broadsides, which means you fire all the guns that you've got. And we were 4.25s, I think. And as a result of that, the Z-26, which was the trailing destroyer, blew up. And the next order was shift target. So we'd We were then after the second destroyer, and all hell went loose when we had to go at the second destroyer, because it was a little more difficult, because they knew then, and they started to get into sort of scattering to attack us, you see, in all sorts of quarters. Now at that point, because all hell was let loose, as you might say, Trinidad fired everything she'd got, multi-bofas, bofas, Orlikins, anything, including torpedoes. Now this is where the danger was, because it is normal when a ship is commissioned, it goes to its training ground, usually the Orkney Islands, where extensive equipment testing goes on. Compasses, gunnery, torpedoes and everything like that. And unfortunately, we had not had sufficient time to test these. We'd merely, the Navy were anxious to get us to sea for convoy protection work and patrol work, because we were losing cruisers, so, you know, right, left and centre. So we really hadn't had time to work up the torpedo section. I think this is an opinion, but it has been established that this is what happened. Now, they fired, we had triple torpedo tubes, and I think they fired three torpedoes. Now, the torpedo mechanism itself is all secured by a large trunk which goes down into the bowels of the ship, and it appears that not only did the torpedoes get shot off, but the trunk ruptured and all sorts of things went wrong. In fact, I think most of them went over the side. So there we were with torpedoes all over the place, and by a sheer fluke, one of these torpedoes, our own, went astray on its course. We don't know the reason. Several theories are. One is that the guiding mechanism was damaged by a piece of ice or whatever in the water, as there were ice floes then. Or the delicate guiding mechanism was upset by the temperature of the water, or whatever. Nobody knows, really. But this torpedo went round a complete circle and honed back in on us. And of course, we were too late when the thing was spotted. We couldn't take evasive action. And she hit us. Now, the reason for the tragedy was this, that in the transmitting station, Mr. Wood, you had two compartments, one about the size of this room. Then there was a door into a second compartment. Now, as was always the way, the bandmaster, being the senior member of the band, did the big job in the big computer section, usually accompanied or supervised by the warrant gunner. The gunner, a gunnery officer, in other words, the warrant gunner. And he had in his crew most of the band.